Hello, and welcome to Lucky 13 episode of Is It Funny? The podcast in which I, your host, Kate Leary, tell you things that I think are funny. And after a bit of a break there, I'm back with an episode on someone who is getting a little extra measure of fame at the moment, Fran Lebowitz. Now, my relationship with Fran Lebowitz goes back to the 70s when she was writing for Interview magazine and other things and beginning her career of appearing on television and so forth. And for me, you know, back as a much younger person in the 70s, she was very much an icon of cool. And I find cool a very tricky subject. I suppose that's a good way to put it. Because cool is so influenced by our culture and definitely not only capitalism, patriarchy. Oh, yeah, let's get the P word out there. This one of the things that struck me this morning as I was jotting down some notes for this, one of my publishers sells a shirt that because publishers sell shirts because merchandise sells better than books. Isn't that sad? But a shirt that features Bill Hicks, the American comedian who probably achieved much greater fame in Britain than he did in the U.S. and is still considered very iconic and very much an indication of cool. And just the thought of problematic as he was as a person. And yes, I mean, quite often a good comedian, but you could never imagine the same sort of shirt dedicated to, let's say, Victoria Wood. And how much cool is about hardness, masculinity, distance. Cool has to feel somewhat unreachable. And, you know, Victoria Wood, every bit is funny, probably in my mind, more funny, but soft, approachable, the feeling of familiarity. So can't be cool. That can't possibly be cool. And again, sort of all these issues of cool and what constitutes cool is very interesting to me. And I, of course, one of the things that will spring to mind is the cool girl, of course, as Gillian Flynn wrote about in her novel Gone Girl, and how much that wonderful monologue about being the cool girl and what it requires to be the cool girl and all the things you have to deny in yourself because anything that is not acceptable within this very narrow framework is simply not there. Can't do it. And related to that, this, again, sort of all the weird connections in my mind, the Popular Culture Association conference, which I have been going to since grad school back in the 90s. I remember the year I was giving a presentation on Megan Abbott's The End of Everything, which actually, just to digress for a second, has recently been published by Retreats from Oblivion, which is the journal for NoirCon, because it is, yeah, Megan Abbott and Gillian Flynn and forgetting who else is on that, was on this panel, not they themselves, people talking about their book. But again, sort of that neo-noir, the women who are really writing the best neo-noir these days. And I just remember that the panel and the crime fiction area is really a mystery and detective fiction area for popular culture. And so older sort of middle-aged women, very, well, they just went off in the question and answer period. I don't think I've got to say much of anything about anything because they just went off on how much they hated Amazing Amy, how much they hated Gone Girl. And it was just fascinating to me that it's like going, wow, you're so invested in patriarchal culture, aren't you? Because she just infuriated them. They were just so angry about her. I'm still thinking about that, obviously, you know, a few years later. And just how this notion of cool has to be this thing that is so brittle, so very brittle. I mean, you can have a picture of a B-movie actor in sunglasses and people go, oh, that's cool. That's really cool. And, you know, you can have a plump middle-aged woman who writes the best novels ever. And no, I'm not talking about myself. I'm thinking of people like Dorothy Hughes and Elizabeth Saxe Holding, who wrote these fabulous noir novels, but, you know, they didn't look cool so they don't get red. So uncool, well, I mean, as a youngster, as a teen, I was certainly always very uncool. And I was quite well aware of being uncool. But of course, you're always kind of studying it and figuring out, well, what does make people cool? How do you become cool? Because you certainly cannot become cool just by being yourself. That was something that was very, very clear to me. Aggressively uncool as I was, and still remain. But Fran Lebowitz was a certain kind of cool that, if not exactly feeling within reach, certainly felt different. And it was, I think, even before I was kind of aware of her lesbianism, that it kind of helped that she didn't seem to have the slightest interest in pleasing men. In fact, she frightened some of them. She was often on the Letterman show, and she clearly frightened David Letterman, which probably isn't that hard. But this idea of not trying to please anybody, which, you know, especially when you're a young teenage girl and many of them wanting to try to please some kind of guy or at least get some kind of interest out of them, it seems really difficult to not have that access, not be able to be incapable of pleasing other people, which, you know, certainly the fate in my life. I've never succeeded at anything that required me to be anything but my weird self. And, you know, that includes writing, academia. There's like you've heard of the glass ceiling. There's like a weirdo ceiling too, where you can only advance to a certain level before you're kind of like, that's it. That's all you get. So Fran Lebowitz, she was, her writing in Interview Magazine, for me, you know, Interview Magazine was kind of a step up. I wouldn't call it exactly maturity, but, you know, it was a step beyond the sort of music, rock music magazines that I had been reading. And it was certainly very different from Rolling Stone with its veneer of rebellion over, you know, this very corporate product. And even the magazines that I love much more, like Cream and Trouser Press, there was really a kind of, what do I want to say, anti-change guy sort of core that didn't really feel accessible, certainly to young women. And Interview Magazine, which sort of straddled this space between popular culture and things that certainly seemed accessible, and the art world, which I was always fascinated with, gave kind of an entree into that, you know, this sort of distant world of New York that seemed impossibly distant, in the same way that London used to seem impossibly distant to me. That there was this kind of world where these things were happening far from where I was living, and that I wanted to at least get some glimpses of from my deep, deep distance. So in her fairly long career so far, you know, spanning decades, Fran Lebowitz has actually published two books. Well, a third that is a combination of the two books. So there's 1974's Metropolitan Life, which was the first one that my brother and I both had. And then Social Studies from 1981, which I always remember from her talking about the strange cover, which airbrushed out the cigarette she was smoking, which had been in the original picture. There's a picture of a portrait that had been done, I think, for Interview. So I just remember that the paperbacks of these, so, you know, I think now I have a hardcover of Metropolitan Life. And I think my brother has a first edition of that. And we both have the Fran Lebowitz reader because she came to the Bard campus and to give a little reading and talk. And so we bought new copies of these books. We already have multiple copies because she was signing them. So I have an autograph from her and had a chance to chat with her very, very briefly. So turning back to the pages of Metropolitan Life, especially from 1974, there's a lot of anachronistic things, of course, which she addresses at least somewhat in the introduction. Some of the humor that I think really sort of borders on racism, and obviously lots of references to things that are very, disco references alone are probably enough to make some of it feel dated. But the usual targets of her skewering are things that are still with us and are still very much part of, you know, human behavior. Her introduction to the book, My Day, an introduction of sorts, pokes a little fun at the kind of soft magazine profiles that follow celebrities around on their day. It starts at 12:35 p.m. The phone rings. I am not amused. This is not my favorite way to wake up. My favorite way to wake up is to have a certain French movie star whisper to me softly at 2:30 in the afternoon that if I want to get to Sweden in time to pick up my Nobel Prize for Literature, I'd better ring for breakfast. This occurs rather less often than one might wish. This is the voice that, if you've seen her in any kind of appearance at all, you'll immediately recognize this sort of world-weary tone and this seemingly not taking anything seriously and yet complaining about everything possible under the sun. There's a piece slightly later. There is no such thing as inner peace. There is only nervousness or death. Any attempt to prove otherwise constitutes unacceptable behavior. And of course, Leibowitz is very big on sort of what's allowable behavior and what is not, especially within the confines of New York City, where behavior is very important. Very few people, she says, possess true artistic ability. It is therefore both unseemly and unproductive to irritate the situation by making an effort. If you have a burning, restless urge to write or paint, simply eat something sweet and the feeling will pass. Your life story would not make a good book. Do not even try. She offers vocational guidance for the truly ambitious, which includes everyone from someone who wants to be a pope to somebody who wants to be an absolute political dictator to, so, you want to be a social climber, and offers the kind of evidence and in terms of a quiz. So you have to choose the right answers in order to be truly on the path that you should recognize. When alone, I most often A, read, B, watch television, C, write sonnets, D, build model planes, E, call the Beverly Hills Hotel and have myself paged. So it's certainly recognizable things. And it's very much about the social life that, despite her sort of self-created myth of being this, you know, curmudgeon who lives alone and never sees anybody, as if you've seen the Scorsese series, then you know that she loves parties. She loves going to parties. She loves talking to people. And although she may spend a lot of time in her apartment reading her thousands and thousands of books, she loves to go out and she also loves to dance. So at odds between how you self-mythologize and what the actual truth is. Many of these same obsessions carry over into social studies written a few years later. Mostly comprised of magazine pieces that are kind of put together sort of after the fact. So the usual sort of difficulty in meeting deadlines that so many writers know is a big part of creating these short pieces. But again, as I say, a lot of the criticisms of the world at large remain the same, trying too hard, she says here. The conversational overachiever is someone whose grasp exceeds his reach. This is possible, but not attractive. Original thought is like original sin. Both happened before you were born to people you could not possibly have met. And this is the piece which also offers her famous observation, the opposite of talking isn't listening, the opposite of talking is waiting. And unfortunately, a lot of people seem to buy into that idea. Her tips for teens, for which she created the notion, think before you speak and read before you think, also has other unflattering tips for teens, like if in addition to being physically unattractive, you find that you do not get along well with others, do not, under any circumstances, attempt to alleviate this situation by developing an interesting personality. An interesting personality is, in an adult, insufferable. In a teenager, it is frequently punishable by law. She also comes up with a list of modern-day saints, including Saint Wayne, who died circa 1975, patron of middle children, invoked against whatever's left over. Wayne was born 2 years after his brilliant and handsome brother Mike and 3.5 years before his perfectly adorable sister Jane. Very little is remembered of his life and works, if any, and his canonization is the result of a unique mix-up in which Mike was made a saint twice and with typical generosity gave Wayne his extra sainthood. There's also Saint Ingmar François Jean Jonas Andrew, patron saint of graduate film students, invoked against going to the movies for fun, detractors of Stan Brakhage, and disbelievers in the genius of John Ford. Saint Ingmar François Jean Jonas Andrew was born in a starkly lit delivery room in the kind of small American town that is all small American towns. From infancy, he was astonishingly perceptive and invariably saw layers of meaning not apparent to the average moviegoer. As early as his 6th birthday, Ingmar François Jean Jonas Andrew displayed the remarkable dual tendency to overwrite and underexplain. Among the many miracles to his credit are getting adults to actually attend a Jerry Lewis Film Festival and introducing a course at an accredited university entitled The Philosophy of Busby Berkeley and Its Influence on Rainer, Werner Fassbinder, and Robert Bresson. Rather than martyr himself, Saint Ingmar François Jean Jonas Andrew sent one of his students. I highly recommend getting the Friendly Boots Reader because it's, one, it's cheap, it's affordable, it's a paperback, but also it has the fabulous, the Frances Ann Leibowitz collection, which imagines her belongings being auctioned off after death and with wonderful illustrations. And I think it would be hard not to enjoy this. The breadth of her references and cultural touchstones. I mean, things as disparate as Wyndham Lewis and How to Get Around Bouncers really shows how much someone who focuses on pretty much one city really gets a broad range of topics worked into this. Because, and again, if you've watched the series with Scorsese, she's interested in all kinds of things, in all kinds of random things, and just follows that curiosity, which I think is certainly one way of being happy. I'll end up with, because I don't want to just keep reading from her book, but one of the last pieces in social studies is an alphabet of New Year's resolutions for others, not for herself, of course. They range from the Baroque to N, which is the very simple one of no hats. And I will leave you with S, which is S. Success is something I will dress for when I get there and not until. Cross my heart and hope to die. As someone who has assiduously avoided dressing for success, I got my current academic job wearing my Doc Martens. So, you know, it can be done. But again, until you reach the weirdo ceiling and then that's it. So, yeah, coasting from here on, I guess, as another car goes by. So, thanks. Hopefully, I will return to semi-regular editions of this podcast. And I'm not sure why my voice raised at the end there. Thank you to those of you who do listen. And I'll see you next time. Bye.